motion picture brains, that's you, fans of light, darkness, competition, celluloid, ditties, ones. Ha! Anyway, welcome back to another episode of the Through the Lens podcast, the unedited audio of our full conversation with a cinematographer. In this episode, we spoke with Ed Lockman. Ed Lockman, ladies and gentlemen, who is known for, amongst other things, Aaron Brockovich, The Limey, Far From Heaven, Virgin Suicides, A Prairie Home Companion, Mildred Pierce on HBO, the miniseries. He is a genius. This guy, I can only say that one other cinematographer who was also on the show referred to him as a painter, which I would agree with. He is a painter. The man paints with light. He picks up lights and he paints with them. He splatters them around the same way you do with toothpaste, except he does it with light and a camera. And he's a genius at it. The guy's amazing. Anyway, we met up with him at his home in New York City in October of 2012. And although this may be, I don't know if it's out of taste, I don't know if I'm talking out of school, but I will say this, the man's apartment is freaking gorgeous, okay? He's got this apartment that don't ask me where it is, I'm not telling you that, but I will say it is the most beautiful apartment I have ever seen in my entire life. I was basically asking him to give it to me, you know, for fun, but he wouldn't do that. I don't know why I asked him. Anyway, Ed welcomed us into his home, into his apartment, and he was incredibly gracious. He was prepared, and then we ended up talking about a bunch of stuff that was not on the plan, and it worked out very well. And it was just an honor to meet really one of the greatest living cinematographers, somebody who has contributed so much to the medium. He worked under Sven Nykvist. He worked under Robbie Muller. He has trained by the best. He is intelligent. He's extremely, extremely thoughtful and philosophical about everything he does. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. If you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, you will find it at www.crafttruck.com as season one, episode, I think, 18 and 19. It's a two-parter of Through the Lens, or you can go to youtube.com/crafttruck. You can also subscribe if you're feeling ostentatious. Should also be noted that during this interview, Ed smoked four packs of cigarettes and blew smoke rings in the shape of koala bears.
Yeah. That's
candid. Man, if this location doesn't rock.
Yeah, that's all right. See how I'm living. There's my bedroom.
If you got a bank vault.
Yeah, I got the vault, right.
You know, so.
Lenses.
Believe me.
You just go high. Yeah, I like that.
But it's a nice bed. It's a pillow. It's a Euro top.
I got a good bed. Yeah. That was right around the corner of the bed.
Where were you born at?
New Jersey. Nothing special.
Where in New Jersey?
Northern New Jersey, Morristown.
Morristown, my wife's from Edison.
Oh, yeah. He's from Jersey, too.
I'm staying in Edison right now.
Here, did you get a shot? All right, let's see.
Took a couple.
Yeah, you want to hear a really funny story with this one?
I do.
Well, I went to a passport, my passport picture thing.
Yeah.
So they always do two lights, you know, like this, bam, bam, double lights in your eyes, yeah. Shadow. So I tell the guy, I'll pay you extra, would you turn that light off? So he goes, what do you want? I just had Mia Farrow in here. I said, look, I'm a camera. I just shot Mia Farrow. Turn the light off. So I gave the guy $15, and the guy turned the light off, and I moved it over, and we took the picture. And that's what's in my passport. It's one light source. I basically paid him twice, so he turned the light off.
So then he turned the light off.
But that was funny. He said, I just had Mia Farrow. Yeah, that's fine. Getting old.
Good job. Can I see this shot? I'll figure it out. Oh, I
I see.
Does somebody have one of these? Because it always goes into that mode. It's fine. It's fine. Now, for him, too, you should go up high. See, you don't want the nose like the shadow. Just go up higher. It's always nicer on the... Go. You know why? Because light usually comes from above. I mean, it's not wrong to do it low, but it's... It'll feel more natural. You can go even a little higher if you want on him. So we're trying to make you look good, too.
Why not? My mother's been trying to do that for years. Yeah. Now my wife's trying to do it.
Pan. Yeah, so it's not in your lens. Keep pan. Oh, you were taking light off?
No, you're off of your back because it's you're getting overexposed on your side.
Oh, really? Even with the black? Is that enough light on him?
Yeah, sure.
Well, go a little higher. Then you won't hit my back. And then you can shelf it. You know, yeah, just go up higher. Yeah, go up higher. It won't hurt.
That's it.
That's it?
That's all she
wrote. All right, that's all she wrote. Yeah. There. That, now it's not so bad, right, on my back?
It's good, yeah.
And you're not hitting your light. Yeah, there's.
Hitting your light?
No, I'm just seeing if you're. No. Pan it more in, or you're not going to
see. Unless it looks good, I have to check.
I don't know. Yeah, probably it's.
You can bend up the thing and guard him a little bit if you want.
Yeah. Sure,
or and look, can you do how much light would you get if you only have two on?
This one. Oh, go ahead.
Pan it more toward you. Pan it.
Sure.
Yeah. There. Do you have enough light on me? I mean, for your. What size frame? Or just point your little thing around. Show me.
Well, right now I'm...
Yeah, that's here. Cool. Yeah, let's just see what happened with the window. I bet you it's blue. Yeah, see, it's... Yeah. What's that? In the corner? Yeah, that's fine. It's like you're in the frame. That's nice.
Yeah.
But maybe have more of the hat or...
More of the hat?
Well, I mean, you cut...
I want to get your face.
Well, you'll get that. I'm not that interesting looking. All right.
Now, so you were born in Jersey, and then you grew up there, and I guess your parents are Jewish?
Yeah. I was never really brought up anything, but they were.
Did you have a bar mitzvah?
I did.
What was that like?
It was fine, you know. Yeah, all I wanted was a... an ice sculpture with its, you know, the sculpture that spit out the fruit juice.
Did you get it?
I got it. That was...
What did your father do?
He was in the film business. He had a movie theater, and we can talk about that on film. Why don't we... let's wait.
Like to talk about that. I would love to talk
about that. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
What's your book card in here?
Good. They need to be formatted, so that's okay.
Alexis?
Yeah?
Oh, sorry. When you get the chance, if you want to just pull up Ed's resume on the... Is there a pass to your Wi-Fi here?
No, I will. See if he can just get in.
Okay.
I mean, I should give you one of these.
What is it?
Well, this has... you know, films I worked on it.
Don's Guest Network or L6 Wi-Fi?
L6.
Yeah, it's a secured, it needs a password.
What is it, Don? Bella Loft 6? Don? Did you get on?
I found the Don's Guest Network isn't locked. You can just go on it.
Oh. Is mine all closed?
Yours is locked up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, nobody's surfing on your.
That's fine.
It's way better because then you.
Well, the Limey.
Well, the Limey was unquestionably something we're going to talk about. Unquestioned. There's so many.
But give me a little time to get to that one if you're going to talk about the Limey. Maybe, like you say, it doesn't matter if I look at my notes. Probably it doesn't matter if I look.
You can look at your notes and stare at them.
All right.
You can do whatever you want. So, wait a minute. So, let's just go back to it. So, if you don't mind telling me, your father owned a movie theater?
Yeah, my father. But let me tell you on camera.
Where are our cameras?
Oh, we are.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
Right.
All right.
I didn't hear roll.
Rolling audio, so that's just we'll just put a picture of you up and we'll just. Well, why don't we get the microphone on?
Well, he's got the microphone on me.
What? No, that one. The boom.
The big boom.
Right. Yeah. This is just to make sure you sound
all
right. Beautiful.
Yeah, right. You can come down probably. No, you can't. Right.
Are we in?
You're good. Right there. It's just to really.
It's pretty decently sensitive.
What is it, a 415?
It's actually just a road.
Oh, a road, right.
Yeah.
We had one of those.
But
just your knuckles, as they go down, that's it?
I think I'm as far down.
All right. Then it's fine. I meddled the most with your light.
Oh, you're fine.
If I come down a little?
If it's somebody had to.
You can pull anything.
You got the right spirit.
Oh yeah. Well, we can't have the wrong spirit with this because it's just too much fun, right?
All right.
Like we're talking about photography. What could be more fun than talking about
photography? That's true. We're talking about filmmaking.
Pardon me?
We're talking about the illusion of reality.
We're talking about the illusion.
You're good there.
Okay.
We're talking about the illusion.
Just you know what? Just bring it up just a titch.
All right. Let them. Well, that's good too. Let them talk. The crew.
Let
the crew talk
over the
interview and the interviewer.
Yeah,
you know, where it's very Godardian. We show the at the end. We put the camera on them.
Yes. that's the trend these days, right? It's like,
right.
But
right.
Then the documentarian got involved in his own subject.
Right. Yeah. We'll take a shot of you guys.
Can you take a photo of him and me?
Yeah. Of course. Did you have to ask? Or, I mean, you know.
Did you have to?
I'm not a sound person. I didn't.
There we go. Alexis hates getting shots taken. I think we should have Ed Lockman trying to take photos
of
Alexis
course.
As much
yeah,
as possible.
Yeah, and then you can transfer this.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, what happened to the boom person? Oh, there's a sound. She's over there. All right. Well, she's hiding over there. All right.
There we go. We got her?
We Bam. Got her.
Ed Perfect. Lockman taking photos.
That's good. I actually did that in Venice, at the Venice film. They have, you know, hundreds of photographers in the photo gallery.
Yeah.
And I took out my Leica and took a picture of them.
Yeah.
That's what went on all over the air. Todd Solondz wasn't in it. The actors weren't in it. It was my picture taking. In fact, you should find that. You can get it on the internet. There's a picture of me at the Venice Film Festival with Life During Wartime.
Life During Wartime at the Venice Film Festival.
Yeah, and there's a picture of me.
How was it working with Todd?
Todd is the loveliest man. You know, I was a little skeptical because I was involved in another project at the time, and I didn't. And his producer got in touch with me, I had seen Todd, you know, talk, and I've seen his films, but. His aesthetic towards camera in some of his films are kind of almost non-photographic.
Well, okay,
they're
so
not.
This is interesting because we spoke with Tom Richmond, who also shot a film with him, and he said that Todd's very straight up. It says like, you know, my favorite filmmaker is Robert Bresson,
Right.
And I want the camera to be as far out of my, you know, far away from my set as possible. If I could put the camera in the next room. I'm translating what he told me.
Yeah, I understand.
And but then by the same token, Tom said that when they were making that film, Palindromes, he started to get more okay with using the camera.
Well, what I understood about Todd was, and this is something I like to do with first-time directors and any director that wants to play this game,
right,
is I like to pre-visualize the story elements, like going through the script and breaking the script down, especially when you've found your locations,
right,
so that the cameraman and the director go there and talk through the scenario. So even though in a way it's a shot schedule and plan, you don't have to hold to it, but at least I want to give the confidence to the director that when he goes into the shooting of the day, he knows with these parts that he'll be able to put the scene together.
Right.
And when I started that process with Todd, I realized, because he's a writer-director and very strong with his actors, he had a visual sense, but he never wanted the visuals, the images, to usurp what he was saying in his storyline.
Right.
And
but can you separate the images in the storyline? I mean,
well,
with a film, inevitably the story becomes the images, right? I know it's talking.
Well, listen, for me and for most cameramen, the language of cinema are images.
Yes.
All right, but not every director is really visual to want to tell the story through him or know how to tell the story image.
Right.
They might have the ideas of what they want to say, but part of the relationship of working with a cinematographer and a art director is creating the language to create those stories. Now, some directors, you know, that I was lucky enough to work with, like Ulrich Seidel, who I've worked with recently, and
you'd made three movies with him.
I did Import Export and then this trilogy, Paradise.
Right.
Paradise, Love, Faith, and Hope.
And they were shot in South America?
Well, no, they were shot in Vienna, and one was shot in Africa.
Wow, okay.
And one was shot outside of Vienna. And I also worked with his cinematographer. What's his name? Oh, I know him very well. Wolfgang Thaler, who's a wonderful cameraman in his own right.
Right.
I always kid them and say I'm a guest worker. I really don't need to be there, but it's nice hanging out with them. But we have a nice relationship. But what I was saying is, so what I realized about Todd, per se, was that his idea of constructing the story with images was a functional, attempt at saying what he needed to say through his narrative, through his dialogue. And I wanted to, what he started to trust me is when he understood that I could find the visual equation, or what I like to think of as what visual metaphors are for telling the story, that the images wouldn't usurp or the images wouldn't be superfluous to the storytelling. In other words, they wouldn't be an element that wasn't integral to what he was saying. When he understood that I could translate the images into what he was saying through the script, we had trust.
Right.
And I had one of the most wonderful relationships working with him, and I couldn't shoot his last film, but I'm going to shoot his next project.
So you're saying you were able to eliminate the irony between the, in the sense of doubling or layering on top of between the image and the point.
Well,
of the story.
That there was an understanding that the images could reinforce what he was saying,
as opposed to rubbing against.
Opposed to like overstating cliche, being a cliche. In other words, a lot of visual imagery that we see in films, I find, are repetitive in the sense that they become cliches and banal kind of approaches to the storytelling because it's a cool shot or maybe it's better you sit or what? No, or you need to fix something?
I was going to tell him he was done.
So what?
It just keeps hitting it and getting us like crazy.
All right. In other words,
the attempt is to transcend the quotidian, how can I say it, the cliches of, in other words, every story should find its own language to tell that story and visually.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, commercials are a perfect example. They rely on the cliche to tell the story.
Yes.
You know, beautiful girl, get the girl because he got the certain kind of product and you look cool, you know. Well, in film, you have to go beyond that. You have to find what your visual cues are to tell this story, but not every story should be told the same. And you don't have to reference the last film you saw because it looks cool.
Right.
You have to find what's integral in that story. What mythology do you find to tell that story that's unique to that story?
Right.
And it could be through music, it could be through writing, it could be through painting, it could be any visual cue, and it should come from the script, and that's something you discover with a director, and some directors are stronger in having a language to tell that story, and like I've worked with Godard and Bertolucci and Todd Haynes, and you know, they find their own language, and you plug into that as a cinematographer. But sometimes, like with first-time directors like Sofia Coppola, you know, you kind of discover what those images are. She loved Badlands, and she, you know, there's kind of a trend now that people revert back to looking at films in the 70s and 80s, I've tried to, in fact, I had a strange conversation with Paul Schrader about what is it that everybody in Hollywood wants to shoot films like the 70s. And he said, what's interesting is it isn't necessarily the visualization, because that's what they get confused about, because they look at bad VHS tapes and tell me that's the look of the film, you know.
Excuse me. You saw Light Sleeper with him, right?
Yeah, Light Sleeper and Touch.
It's a great film.
Yeah, thanks. But what he said to me, which I didn't really totally think about, was he said it was the subject matter. That in the 70s, there was more of an openness in Hollywood to discover new subject matter. There was more openness to, like, explore political and social issues. You know, it was the Vietnam War.
And it was happening both through the content and the form.
Exactly. There was more experimentation. People were more open to experimentation in the form.
Yeah.
But also that the content was driving the stories.
Yeah.
You know, people like Hal Ashby and so Bob Rafelson. So that's what I think people are in search for.
Now.
I don't know. I've been going to a lot of festivals of recent with Ulrich's new film, and I've been, I don't know, for better or worse, a judge at certain festivals and had retrospects. And I see less and less that I find compelling or interesting, because I think people are being, I don't know, maybe more conservative in how they're telling their stories.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, it's actually a very hard time because, you know, if it was like really, there was about 10 years where making an independent film was like really cool, because there was still like this delta between, you know, if you could get $1 million or $2 million together to make your movie, and what separated a movie from some schnook was basically, you know, that you were shooting on 35.
Right.
And now there's this thing that's happened with the consumer and the professional where these technologies have merged.
Oh, you're always supposed to turn your phone off the set.
But that, you know, that's okay. We forgive. We're very open. You can answer the phone.
I can get
strikes.
Please answer.
I'm asking you to answer the phone. I want
to see who this is.
Yeah.
Hello?
I'm speaking to Ed, please.
You're speaking.
Maybe it's Laura. How are you?
All right, Laura, you're on an interview right now. Actually, this is a Canadian.
Oh, let's put her on speaker.
Well, I don't know if she'll want to be on speaker. This is for a web show.
Yeah.
What did you do in Canada, Laura? What did you do in Canada? They'll know you. What was your big position?
I was the programmer for Showcase.
Oh, She was the programmer. This is Laura Mamishman.
Oh, Laura McLish, how are you? It's Jeff Glickman, Jesse Eichmann's partner.
How are you?
Good. How are you? We just ran into each other at the Four Seasons. At the festival?
Hilarious. Yeah, are you guys in New York or where?
Yeah, we're in New York right now. We're interviewing Ed for this new online content we're doing called Craft Truck.
Awesome. Yeah. I love it. Okay, well, you go interview Mr. Lockman.
Well, you're on the interview now, too, and your phone number is, too, apparently. So
I'll... Okay, so you broadcast my phone number, you guys.
Just because you're Robert Redford's new partner doesn't mean we're not going to put your number online. You know, I mean,
seriously. Yeah, do not do that, please. You can call me anytime. I don't want 90%.
All right. I'll
online community. All right.
I'll call you later. All right. I only talk to them because.
3 or 4 at Radical.
All right. 3 or 4. All right. I only talked to them because they were Canadian, and you're Canadian. I want you to know.
You're hilarious. No, but I need you because Redford is coming next week. So how about 3:30 tomorrow?
Fine.
Available?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
I say 3:30. What do
Bye.
I have to?
Hope
All right.
Talk.
Ciao.
Bye.
Ciao.
Big hug.
That's hilarious, Laura McCullishlin.
So you couldn't see your number, right?
You can.
Will you fog it out?
We'll digit it out. Anyway, so
where were we?
We're talking about visual language, but I want to pull full stop and go. Yeah, but full stop.
And now we'll see your wristwatch.
Yeah, see my wrist. I want to put a full stop and go to something else here. In case I lose my watch later.
Yeah.
Ed Lockman, master thief. So your father owned theaters.
On my mother's side, it started, my mother's side, my grandfather that I never knew because he died when I was 3, owned vaudeville theaters. He actually was in the liquor business, then the prohibition came in, and then he got into vaudeville and owned vaudeville theaters throughout New Jersey.
Right.
And then when vaudeville went out, they became movie theaters. So one of my father's first jobs there when he got out of University of Penn, and he worked for my grandfather, and then he owned a movie theater himself in New Jersey. And then he was the distributor for the light sources, Arc Carbon's projector lights.
Yeah. Yeah.
For projectors, and then he was actually the first person to bring in the xenon bulb
into North America,
and that was his company. So I was around film my whole life, but I never took it very seriously. And I used to put popcorn. I can't even look at popcorn now, but I used to put the popcorn in the bag as a kid, and then go look at movies. But for me, movies were just kind of some ridiculous escape. I never really saw it very seriously. Then I took a course at a university. I went to Harvard at that point, and it was like film appreciation with
You got
Dwight
into Harvard. What year did you get into Harvard?
Oh, God. I was there around 66, 67.
So you must have been very, very good in school. I mean, they have a lot of nepotism. Your father...
No, they weren't. No, it was just, I don't know. What happened, but I got in, but I didn't stay. I was there for about a year and a half, 2 years.
Why'd you leave?
It was the 60s, drugs, rock and roll, and drop out.
Did you go to Paris and hang around cafes?
No. I went to Columbia, then I went to Ohio University, and then I did go to France. I went to University of Poitiers and Tours.
At what point did, were you always taking stills?
No, I was saying, I took this one film appreciation course at Harvard, and then I started to realize that images got on the screen for a reason. They just didn't magically get up there, and so then I started making little Super 8 films, and they were kind of documents or documentaries about different people that I met. And but because of my painting background, studying studio arts and studying art history and whatever, I always thought about painters when I photographed things, about how they would approach a certain school of painting because of a certain social or political position. So, I was like, I was in German Expressionism. So when I did Desperately Seeking Susan, the reason the colors are not naturalistic, expressionistic, because I was thinking about Otto Dix, Kirchner. I was thinking about the German expressionists to create this abstract world. And
were you a big German expressionism?
Well, that, I think that was kind of the what I was interested in primarily. In, when I was in art history, I was primarily interested in German expressionism, the art between the two worlds.
What about in the film world, like
I really discovered
Sunrise.
No, not so much. I in film, I guess, when I had this film appreciation course, and then later I was into Italian neorealism, and I was into the New Wave, Nouvelle Vague, and you know what was happening in the 50s and 60s in cinema that you know was not that far behind where I was. So I could, and then I really understood American film actually through the New Wave. I started to understand what Hollywood was doing because, you know, the Cahiers de Cinéma with the writing about why they were interested in certain American directors like Nicholas Ray, Howard Hawks, and Sam Fuller. And then, ironically, I got to work with those people. You know, I worked with Sam Fuller with Wim Wenders on Lightning Over Water, and then I got to
work with Sam Fuller.
Well, he's in the film as an actor.
Right.
He's also in Kings of the Road. And I did a making of that film, of them shooting, it's called Report from Hollywood. And I did a long interview. In fact, I just found the one copy of it in Munich, at the Munich Film Archives. Yeah. And I want to retransfer that because it's a wonderful interview with Sam Fuller.
He's one of the great all-time interviewers with the cigar.
Oh, yeah, he's a star.
There's, I think, was it, I'm not sure if it's Pickup on South Street, or is that his? No, is it,
yeah,
is that,
that's is his that, film.
Is that a Pickup on South Street or another one where he there's a French TV broadcast of him watching it, commenting on it as he goes.
Oh, you know, that series was just shown at the New York Film. It's a wonderful series. An interview with Godard and Fritz Lang that's unbelievable. There's a whole like half hour piece with John Cassavetes riding in a car and then walking through his house in his editing room. There's one on Shirley Clarke. I did a film with Shirley Clarke. I never knew she was so incredibly, you know, articulate, because I worked with her on her last film, the Ornette Coleman film, Made in America. But this is so wonderful. You know, she's in her room in the Chelsea Hotel.
Wow.
Talking about filmmaking and her, you know, when she did her early, you know, features like The Connection and Portrait of Jason, and it was wonderful.
See, you get into these things, and then I mean, at what point was the okay? I'm a cinematographer, or do you even associate that way now?
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem being a cinematographer. I mean, what happened was people saw my little films. And they said, hey, will you shoot for me? So I thought it would be an easy way to learn how to make films on other people's mistakes, in a way, because the filmmaking process is an expensive process.
Yes.
So I started shooting for other people all along making my own little films. I made documentaries and kind of experimental films. And so then I kind of oh my God, I can actually make my money at this, you know? So,
my mom's not crying.
And that I was actually doing, working in film, you know, because the tragedy is, it's what was such an expensive media that directors don't get the amount of experience that even a cinematographer does, because cinematographers can work all the time.
It's true, yes.
So it was just a great time for me that way. And then I got to work with people like Sven Nykvist when he came to America, because he had to have a standby DP.
What did you learn from Sven?
Well, it's hard not to learn. How little you need to create an image that looks like you have everything. He always minimized what he did to a certain kind of simplicity that was always a strength for me. And also that he was a wonderful operator. He was a remarkable Are you staying going, Don? I'll reword that question. You are editing this, right? The incredible thing about Sven was, one, his temperament, how he worked with people. You always had the feeling like his needs came second, you know? But also the simplicity of how he used light and the camera. And he was a wonderful, probably one of the greatest operators I've ever been around. There was always a human quality to his operating. When I look at Bergman films that was the lighting cameraman and operator, I could always feel his personality. And it's something that also someone like Robbie Muller, I worked with Robbie Muller, and I used to love his sense of rhythm with the camera. And to me, like, you know, when I don't shoot, or what I look to in another cinematographer or operator, is that it's like creating music in a way. It's a nonverbal way of communicating cinematography images, but that there's a rhythm to an image as there is a rhythm in music. And it's the timing you are with that movement to the subject, how that subject moves, how you move to that subject. I think I got to turn off my phone. Sorry, I thought I did.
You need not apologize, Ed.
All right, sorry. All right. So images.
It's just going to start. Yeah,
you can push it over. Tell me when you're ready.
Oh, can you walk around that? It's impossible to walk around that way.
All right, I'll walk around that way.
I can pick it up.
Okay, go ahead.
That images have a rhythm, and in a way, images have a rhythm, and in a way, a cinematographer, the cameraman behind the camera, is another performer, and there can be this kind of visual dance with an image to the subject that I always find very compelling. And so when I would look at camera work by Sven Nyquist or Robbie Muller, or, you know, a great operator, and it's something you really can't teach to someone. They either now it's your phone.
Hey Jess, you're in the middle of an interview right now. Well, because I had Andrew his phone, and it was Laura McAtishan on the phone. I'll talk to you later. Goodbye. There we go.
All right.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
All right. So what we're saying is, I'm saying images have a rhythm, but that rhythm is someone that's behind the camera. It's also a director's vision of how he uses the camera, but it's also the way the camera interacts with that subject, because no one's ever in the same place at the same time. You know, even in multiple takes, people move differently.
Yes.
And so you sense that as a viewer, and certainly as someone that's aware of, you know, images as another cinematographer.
Did you do a lot of operation yourself?
I always operated myself, you know, and only when larger films where, you know, there's a lot of politics involved and you really need to be off the camera to deal with everything else. You know, kind of the Hollywood system of efficiency that, you know, you can't do both jobs at the same time.
Right. And that's the understanding. Well, not to jump topics.
I don't care.
But you talk about the personality, the rhythm of the operator, and how you picked this up from Sven
Nyquist and Robbie Muller.
And all these things, but what came to my mind was there's this one, there's many shots in The Limey that have an incredible rhythm to them. Two that come to mind. One is the tremendous sequence where Stamp walks back into the warehouse, pulls the gun out of his shoe, walks back in, it all happens off camera. It was scripted that way. Mr. Soderbergh shot it that way, you shot it that way. And the other one, and I want to talk about that one, the other one, and he walks all the way back, I'm fucking coming, you know, and you just
hold the frame.
Because it was handheld.
Right.
And
the work there, you just feel it, that it's just perfect, whatever perfect means.
Right.
And the other one is maybe earlier in the movie, when we introduce Peter Fonda, and he's in his place, and he's after the disaster at the party, when Stamp has killed someone by throwing them over the edge, and Peter Fonda goes, you know, well, and he runs off camera, like runs off like stage right,
uh-huh.
And you sort of followed him. It was a wide shot,
uh-huh.
of the room,
right.
Do you, I mean,
well, you know, this brings up a point. The time I worked with Godard, he said something to me in this one sequence. Well, he's actually on the set of One from the Heart.
Uh-huh.
And he was doing something called like the anatomy of a shot. He was breaking down a shot.
Right.
So Francis would do like 17 takes of the same scene. It was like a dancing scene in Las Vegas, outdoors in the street, in the studio setting of the Las Vegas Strip. And what Godard would do is he was smoking a cigar, shooting Super 8 and doing sound, and I was shooting with an assistant, Mitch Dubin, who's a wonderful operator in his own right for Steven Spielberg. And I was shooting 35 with a 35 BL. It was a zoetrope camera.
Yeah.
And Godard came up to me and said, keep everybody in the middle of the frame. So he would shoot a grip, and he would be dolling, and I would just keep the grip in. Then it would be a dancing girl. No, no, no. Then it would be one of the actors. Then it would be an extra, right? And I thought, wow, that's going to be really weird as an image, you know, just keeping everybody in the center of the frame. And then when I saw dailies, back then we had dailies, I go, oh my God, that the image is I couldn't explain. The compositions were so strong because you'd always cut and that next person would always be center of the frame.
Right.
And then I thought about it. Godard's idea of imagery was never because of aesthetics, but because of an idea that he had about an image. And even the images that you're talking about, it isn't we haven't seen shots so-called handhold or a shot that's a wide shot moving in the room, but because there's an idea behind the image, that's what makes an image strong.
Right.
You know, that's what makes an image compelling, that it transcends its cliche of handhold. Because I even think handhold today is overused, like to create this emotional realism that we're seeing something in real time. And if it's not done well, it detracts from what you're seeing. Someone like Chris Doyle, like in The Mood for Love, it's pure poetic, and it brings the viewer into a world. Or
yes.
What Wolfgang Thaler, that works with myself and Ulrich Seidel, he's got a wonderful rapport with the subject matter, and there's a certain kind of poetry in his movement with the subject. So even though it's true, we shot, I would say, 95% of the Limey, not just hand-hold, but not on a tripod. It might be wherever you could place the camera, which today we can do with digital cameras any place.
But you were doing it with an Arri camera.
Yeah, we were doing it with a 35mm camera. And it allowed you to place the camera in a place you normally wouldn't put the camera because of a tripod, you know, because of a hi-hat. And that was Steven, because Steven, I think, always conceptually thinks about what images are. And a film like The Limey, we were really referencing John Borman's film
Point Blank.
Point Blank.
Which he's a huge fan of.
Yeah, and you know, the film noir, the fractured time.
Yeah.
And then Mike Hodges' Get Carter, which was like the first,
right.
You know, noirish, hard-boiled,
British
working-class kind of film. Revenge plot, like, you know, the Terrence Stamp character. So because you have those references, those games you play to create this language. And then the way Stephen played with time. He said it was something he was playing with in Out of Sight, but never really,
licked?
Worked it was where we would be in one scene and then you would say to the actress, let's just run the lines that we did yesterday in the other scene. I don't know how I'll use it. But he did kind of know. And then he plays with that intercutting the dialogue from different scenes. And what start and then also playing the dialogue over the people not talking.
Right.
And what happens is, which brings up an interesting point about cinematography, is it creates the interior world of the character. And that's, for me, the hardest thing to do. In literature, you can enter the interior world of the character in a paragraph. You can say what the person is thinking. But it's much harder to show place, where you are. Where in cinema, it's just the opposite. You can show place, location, in one shot, but it's harder to show what people are thinking or feeling from the interior.
Yes.
And I think if there's any thematic that I try to approach in images is how I can enter the interior world of the character to embrace in the story what the character is going through psychologically that will allow the images to portray that.
Right. And
it's like a sense of discovery. Have the actors kind of be able to visualize what their discovery is of their own character and their own dilemma and tension.
Right. On the subject of that, when we're talking about the scenes that were cut, there's a sequence where, I mean, right from the beginning, it's that movie changed editing. Didn't change editing. It changed our understanding, mm-hmm. in North America, at least, of what was capable through editing. It was revolutionary. And as one editor, a friend of mine, put it to me, he said he thought that was it. It was going to blow the doors open. American cinema was going to change it. And then maybe it's because it's just such a masterpiece of a film. It doesn't feel like its legacy hasn't yet found itself, but the film itself is a masterpiece. It's one of the best movies of the past 20 years, 25 years. There's a sequence where Stamp and is it Leslie Ann Warren?
Yeah.
Are walking, and great performances around the board of the movie. Everybody in the movie is outstanding. Are walking and they're talking about what happened with his daughter. You know, and it goes from them walking along the boardwalk to this location, that in her apartment, outside and inside. And did you know? How much did Mr. Soderbergh let you in to what he was going to do with this?
He intimated what he was going to try, but I really didn't understand it at the time. It was really the editing process.
Was that a little bit of a was it?
No, I'm
cards close to the
no,
chest.
No, not at all. Okay. I mean, you know. Part of making a film is different stages. This is writing.
Right.
Like Godard says, a film isn't words, it's images.
Right.
So he does film. I did one film script of his, you know, as images, you know. So he explores or experiments his stories through images that he feels. But anyway, regardless of that, the point is, there has to be an evolution in how you ultimately the script is not the final film until you get the actors there, the way you tell the story with the images, and then the final part is the editing and how you construct the story. It's like really the editing is rewriting the story in a sense.
It is.
I'm going to wait for her. All right. So really, editing is really rewriting the story. And that's why I think a lot of writer-directors love the editing process, because it's a chance, again, to interpret the language of cinema in another context of the editing, which will speak back to you in a different way than even you imagined.
Yeah.
Because of the juxtaposition of the images and the story.
It's also why writers tend to hate editors. Or, you know,
maybe. Well, or they don't feel it represented what they're writing is. Well, it never can.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's why it's a film.
Yeah.
That's why it's a film and not a play or a novel. What's your next question?
Well, no, this is all great. So there's the photography of the Limey is stunning. It's absolutely stunning from every yardstick you can apply to it. First and foremost, from the fact that it works so well in this cut in the montage that the movie is, and the way it's cut together. But the actual lighting of it is so dynamic and interesting. And there's one consistent thing that happens a lot, particularly through the first part of the movie, but it happens throughout, which is we'll be in a location and the window, the outside, will be so overblown that it creates this electricity to the images. And I read somewhere that when you were shooting Aaron Brockovich, that you turned to Steven, if I may call him Steven, at some point said something like, does it have to be 10 stops over like it was in the Limey? How did this come about? Was this his idea, your idea?
Well, no, I mean, look, it was a naturalistic film. In other words, we wanted to shoot the Limey like, which it was, so-called in Hollywood terms, it was an independent, low-budget film. So we're using the means of not relighting everything, like using actual locations, working with different color temperatures between tungsten daylight and fluorescent, which I love, which really came out of like what I do in Europe, you know, because you don't have all the lights and the time to do everything, so you work off of what you have.
Right.
And I think that comment wasn't exactly right. I mean, what we gained from the Limey out of this naturalism, but also it was a heightened reality. I mean, the thing is, I think people get hung up that reality, that film represents reality, but really it's the illusion of reality, because number one, what's reality but illusion? But two, we're recreating the illusion of creating a reality with film, right?
Right.
So it was a heightened reality. So I play with color tempers. I play with natural lighting. I play with movement that wasn't always motivated by the action. It was there was an independence to the camera. And in a sense, what we did was recreate that in how you do a larger budget, a big budget Hollywood film with a $20 million star, Julia Roberts, how you make an independent film with those means. And that's what Steven wanted to do. Was he didn't want, like, he said he didn't want to see any lighting trucks, so we would hide like a street over. We still have all the apparatus of what you have, because everybody needs this, that, and the other thing. You know, the second needs the third needs the fourth. But we did everything possible to reduce the filmmaking process to allow the story to be what was most important.
Which is the actors and the camera.
Yeah, and then how we approached Aaron Brockovich, we shot on all real locations that we could, as close to the real locations that the events actually happened, shooting in that town. We shot a lot of times with the real people, like in the town hall meeting. Those are the actual people that were affected by the pollution and the contamination of the water. And I tried to shoot it very, I didn't, like in the car shots in the day, I didn't use any car lights on the car. And it's partly because, you know, a tribute to the film stocks that Kodak was making that were so good that you really could work off of, but it's also knowing how to like balance the negative, you know, and
right.
It's, so that was more the approach. It was more the way, Steven, it was the other way. He would say, do we really need a light? You know, would there be a scene in a room? And I thought, oh, could I just have one light? Yeah. But the light would be outside the window or whatever.
Now, is it at all a challenge as a cinema? Oh, there's a couple questions. I'm just going to spit them all out at the same time.
So, Don, can you just, you'll sit there. I'm just saying, Don, see it, right? You blocked Don. It's good.
I blocked Don?
That's good. All right.
So the questions I have for you, well, I definitely want to talk about the flashback sequences with the specialty made pull down from Claremont. Two is the close-up, the medium shot, actually, of Stamp at the beginning, sitting smoking a cigarette in the hotel room, which is something that, for whatever reason, that one photograph comes back to me over and over and over again in my head. I can't stop thinking about it when I think of, I mean, not not crazy, but I'm saying, you know, when I think about photography, that shot, it's in the first 5 minutes. It's, you know, it's the montage of what brings Stamp to America.
Right.
Sitting in the hotel room with a sort of a beige shirt on, and he's smoking, and then you can see the backlight on the smoke. And then, well, there was more that you just brought. Oh, yeah, and then the sequence in the warehouse when he confronts... what's his name? The wonderful actor that's on Sons of Anarchy. I forget his name.
Yeah, I know who you mean.
William Lucking. Bill Lucking, right?
No.
Is that his name?
No. He did. I forget his name.
And it's green. It's green overhead fluorescence.
Right. Oh, right. Right.
And you
maybe
didn't correct it.
Right.
At least didn't look like you corrected it.
No, I didn't. Probably added green to it.
Probably.
I've been fired over that.
You got fired over that?
Oh, yeah. Not over that film, but in Bad Santa, which a lovely director, Terry Zwidoff.
Yeah.
The studio, you know, we were shooting Bad Santa. It was like in Southwest malls, Christmas. So I wanted to show Christmas not in the typical archetypal red, green, white.
Yeah.
You're in fluorescent situations, and it's like a magenta, and it's a lime green yellow. And so, you know, I wanted to show kind of the aberration, aberration of the world. That, you know,
the
what
film
one
was
doesn't feel
bad Santa.
Well, also, but yeah. You know, you never feel like it's Christmas in the Southwest or L.A. in all that sun.
Right.
So I wanted to reinforce that. So I played with the fluorescent. And word came back, do you really want it that green? What? Where's the Christmas colors? So I tried to explain to him. I said, well, you could take it out, but that was, you know, how we approach it. And Terry's background is, he loves comedy. He did Art Crumb. And,
yeah.
And they were upset about that, and they wanted to come between me and Terry anyway because I was always defending him and his choices. So... they said they're over creative differences, but they always say that. But it was the creative difference with the Weinstein Company, not with Terry. But then they loved me on, you know, Todd Haynes' film. I don't even think they knew I was on the other film.
Far From Heaven.
Right.
Also an incredibly gorgeously shot movie, and I want to talk about that one too. Okay, so the pull down, the flashback. Flashbacks are this thing in movies, right? We recently met with André Perrick, who's a great cinematographer, and we talked about the flashbacks in Blue Valentine and how subtle they were, that it was really a lens difference. That everything in the modern day was very long and everything in flashback was wide and close.
I see.
But so often, you know, you get people doing flashbacks and they punch up the color, they punch down the color, they desaturate, they oversaturate, they black and white, brighter, every way to make sure the audience knows that it's a flashback. You did something in this movie, you and Steven did something in this movie that really made it feel like it was a blurred out memory, that it was something that we couldn't quite grasp, that we couldn't quite remember. And this wonderful use of the sound with Cliff Martinez's score, with the bells.
God, you remember more about this film than I do.
I probably watched it like 20 times.
Wow.
So just describe, why don't you describe for us what?
Well, you know, one always faces the same problems. How do you deal with flashback? And, so I was looking for different ways to do it, and I don't know if it was at the time kind of a trend, or I had done it in a commercial, but it was taking the shutter out of sync, and so it's like slit scanning. It's like the film going through, not registered to the mirror, and so the lights would scan. Any highlights would be this blur.
Right.
Because it wasn't stopping at the right, you know, perf to hold the film.
Right.
And we just came upon that as an idea of trying to do that. So I took my Airy 3 and took it out of sync, and we just, and it, I don't know, you know, it's interesting what you say, the effect of it was for you, because what, honestly, I can say, you know, as an image maker, a cinematographer, you're always exploring ideas, but you're not quite sure if they're going to work or not for the effect that you're trying, you know? And I guess that worked in that way. I felt like it worked, but I didn't really always understand how it could work on a psychological level. Because, and that brings up a point, images aren't just representational, but they're a psychological view of how you're telling a story for the characters and for the audience. And so that's what you're always trying to look for, or what I like to look for when I look at films like, you know, I just saw Rose and Gina, the new Sally Potter film that's wonderful, and that cameraman is a Robbie Ryan, I think his name is.
Yeah, yeah.
And he also did the Arnold film, The Wuthering Heights. You know, he's really exploring other language, and it's wonderful.
Can you just take a second to tell me about that medium close-up shot? Do you even remember it? Or,
you know, I think that shot, I know the one he's sitting on the bed.
Yes.
I think that the camera, it wasn't necessarily handhold. It was just on a chair across from him. And maybe just the height of the camera, thinking about it, you feel like you as the audience could be sitting in a chair across from him, having that, it's almost like how you, like I'm looking at you and you're looking at me. You feel somehow that the camera is put you in the field of view of that camera as another person.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's thousands of close-ups we shoot, but somehow that close-up affects you because you felt some intimacy with that image.
Yes.
And I think it has to do with that it feels like the height of your eye line of someone sitting across from in the room. That somehow that camera position puts you in that space of the room.
Yes.
In the relationship of him.
Yeah.
To his thought process. You know?
Yeah, no, it was. And you're absolutely right. It's almost like Ozu's Tokyo Story.
Right, the Tama.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's absolutely that. Were there any lights on him?
I think I had one light. You know, it's a courtyard building, or he was on the second floor. And I think there was one light on a crane outside one of the windows. And also, you know, I work with the same gaffer for like 30 years, John DeBlau. And we love to light in a way, the way light actually affects space rather than lighting the subject. You know, Connie Hall talked about this from time to time. So we would come in maybe and light a wall that you didn't even see, or maybe you do see a part of it. And that ambient light is what created the light on him. And it feels very naturalistic because that's the way real light would be affected. Instead of saying, oh, I have a movie light, so I'll put the guy in the movie light. So a lot of times when I'm shooting a naturalistic film, I try to mimic many ways that light affects space, like Mildred Pierce, per se.
Right.
That was a film that could have easily been shot like film noir, the 30s. You know, sure, scuro lighting, strong camera angles, but again, Todd Haynes came up with the idea of let's look at Mildred Pierce, one from the book, not from the film noir viewpoint of Michael Kurtz, and shot it brilliantly as film noir, but look at it from a neo noir of the 70s, the way Chinatown was shot, or the way Gordon Willis shot, you know, Clute or whatever, which was much more of a reductionist look. It was more it simplified the elements of telling this story. And I think it came out of partly out of commercials at the time where they used longer lenses, the lighting was more naturalistic, but still expressionistic. So, and then I tried to use a color palette in Mildred Pierce of early color photography, of like the Farm Security Administration, you know, or when they were experimenting with color film early on. And so that what didn't have the full color range. There was more magentas and greens and not as many saturation in the colors.
Right, so it was a limited palette. What was it like working on something like that where it's a six part, it's a longer arc?
Well, it was hard. HBO says it's not television, it's HBO, but you're on a television schedule. But but the truth is they were incredibly supportive, and they would be the first to say, if you need more time, take it. Or in the post, they let me in the color correct longer than I normally would have been allowed on a television show. So they were incredibly supportive for the quality of the work and understood what Todd was trying to do. I was trying to reference, you know, Saul Leiter, a street photographer, a contemporary Robert Frank, who looked at photography more like a painter, more like images in abstraction than social realism. And so there's those parts of the film that create this kind of psychological kaleidoscope prism world for her, where you feel like she's always maybe being observed or watched, which is by her daughter Vita, but we don't know. As the camera, we feel in the audience that maybe we're viewing her from the outside, so her world is broken through prism windows, mirrors. There's a certain distance to her as her world is fracturing and coming apart. And so those are all ways, you know, you can use camera language, but you have to come up with the ideas to use the camera language, you know. And so that's, to me, what cinematography is about, understanding what your ideas are to tell a story.
Can you, you know what, I'm going to ask it.
Yeah, stop you there.
I'm going to restart. You're getting eloquent.
Yeah, it's all right.
Lovely answers. Love
well, you're good too, though. Yeah, I mean, you know your subject matter.
I'm passionate about something, so I study it.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's good.
And that's it. You're speaking so well, and
can I just watch your backpack?
Yeah, sure. Oh, okay. Thanks. No problem. So, because let me know when you're online, Lexis, and I can.
I'm on.
Oh, you're on? Okay, cool. Thanks. So, let me just ask you then this, because we're speaking so well about the theory of photography and the theory of cinematography and what makes motion pictures cut together and whatever. Composition.
Mm-hmm.
I asked this question yesterday to another cinematographer, about the difference, and I said lighting versus framing, and he said, well, they work together.
Uh-huh.
You know, because if I want to shoot you, and then, but this is too bright, so now I gotta lower that, otherwise the composition
mm-hmm.
is up.
Mm-hmm.
What is your approach to composition? I mean, yes, you've defined the idea that the shot has to have an idea, and that central idea is going to drive that shot from being cliche into being, it's not just an over the shoulder.
Right.
It's the idea that we're in the room and we're outside this discussion or whatever
right.
it is, you
right.
know, driving your idea. But what is it about composition?
Uh-huh.
What's the approach to composition for Ed Lockman, or what
I respond to?
Yeah.
Well. Maybe because of my painting background,
mm-hmm.
but I always looked at the frame as independent of itself. In other words, I always try to compose to the spatial relationships in the frame. So I always try to find a balance of what is in that image to tell the story. And I always feel, I like wider lens or medium lenses, because I always feel the environment says something about the character in that space. And like when I think part of the reason I liked Wim Wenders' early films and Robbie Muller's work is because they always used a 25 millimeter lens.
Always.
And I would say primarily. Okay. You know, he would maybe go to a 40, but he didn't work much with longer lenses. I haven't seen his films of late, but that was his lens of choice, kind of like Ozu only shot with a 50 millimeter, you know, or The Last Picture Show was only shot with a 40 millimeter.
The whole movie
was shot with a 40 millimeter.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I don't think it was a 32. I think it was a 40. Maybe it was a 32. I don't know. You can look
one
up.
So you were a 35, 40 guy.
No. I loved the idea of a 25, which would be a little wider than what's considered a 50, which is normal in 35, because I like the spatial relationship of the environment. And
just to be clear, that's a 25 on a Super 35?
Back then it was just a straight 35.
Straight 30 Academy.
Right.
So, okay, so compared to a Super 35, it's kind of like a maybe a 35 millimeter.
Maybe,
lens.
Yeah,
okay.
Something like that. Okay. Yeah, 32. So, but I don't think there's any hard and fast rules. It's just, I'm always interested in the spatial relationships of the environment that you find the character in. That is, just because it's a close-up, I don't want to relinquish what's around that person in the space of that close-up.
Right.
Because I think it somehow is a comment on the world that that person is existing in or part of. And, you know, there's certain photographers who I always love their compositions, like Chris Menges is someone that I always revere his compositions and show a real intelligence to the way he shows an image, or I'll reference Chris Doyle and many times Roger Deakins, you know.
Yeah.
It isn't about the how can I say, the technique of close-up, medium, long shot, but finding what the content is of the image in itself, and trusting that you can make a frame that can express a feeling about the character, or the character finds himself in that frame. And, you know, that was something that we obviously explored with the Douglas Sirk, you know, Far From Heaven, because he would use moving masters. I realized something. Someone asked me this the other day. They're going to do a re-edition of... All That Heaven Allows, and Written on the Wind, and
right.
Criterion. They asked me to do the color correction, you know, for which is a real honor
for
Russell Meddy, you know. And but we're going to go back, and then I was explaining to Lee, who runs Criterion, that I think the way his films looked the way they did, because I tried to analyze that when I was shooting Far From Heaven, was that he would do, he shot these films very quick in the back lot, like 18 days. And even though we were on a set, he would shoot a moving master. And then when he would shoot the close-up within the scene, he would just pop in a tighter lens.
Right.
Because he didn't have time to like move the camera for each shot. Like today,
yeah,
you know.
So you'd get a full scene master, basically almost like a proscenium.
Right.
And then just...
He would just cheat in with a tighter lens,
yeah.
You know.
But in order to make that cut work, because they're basically on the same angle,
same axis, which normally you wouldn't do that.
You would have to go a lot longer.
Yeah,
you'd have to go to slow.
Or you might move in, but the point was he didn't have to change his lighting. He only had to move the lens in, and they could finish their day. You know,
right.
Shooting, you know, whatever they were shooting, 6, 7, 8 pages a day.
Right.
But that created a certain kind of aesthetic. You know, it's like when I did a film like True Stories, I was trying to break the frame in that film. I was trying to shoot it like a William Eggleston photograph, where he breaks frames. You know, they're not classically well what you would consider
composed.
Uh-huh. And the lighting is not interesting per se, like cinematic. You know,
uh-huh.
It's kind of flat. So back then, that was like, I don't know, 20 years ago or whatever, or maybe a little less, 15, I was trying to do kind of punk photography before I knew what punk photography was, because I was trying to understand the sensibility of what made a William Eggleston photograph a William Eggleston photograph. But what I realized after that process, when the film was cut together, people really didn't think it was so weird because it was consistent. So to me, that's another factor about cinematography, is that you find a style, and you don't always know exactly what that style is, if it's working or not. It kind of has to speak back to you in dailies or after a week or two of shooting, if it's what's working. But that you're consistent with what you're doing, and the audience will go with it, you know, and it will create its own new aesthetic in a way.
Right.
And they don't understand it, but they have a feeling from it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the old, I don't know where I read this, but it's something that if I'm talking about a conversation with somebody about a screenplay, and you know, and the screenplay is a story, you know, when you sit down, people don't realize this until they go to make a movie.
Right.
They don't realize, you know, that there's an old line about editing. Editing takes a critically ill patient and gets them into stable condition,
uh-huh.
and then sound gets them up and walking around the room.
Uh-huh.
That's good. But it, you know, it, they don't realize how hard it is to cut something together. Period. That makes sense.
Right.
To shoot something that can be cut together, and then to cut it together in a way that makes sense.
Right.
And I lost my train of thought. What you were talking about just now was, you were talking about the, what were you just mentioning? I went one step back, and then I was going to come back through this. I forgot.
Oh, we're both brain dead.
We're both brain dead at this
point. What were we talking about?
We were discussing moving, tightening, putting a tighter lens on.
The Douglas Sirk way, you know, you would use these moving masters.
Yeah, no, but it was also, you also talked about, we were talking about, God, I lost it.
What that did for the editing, how it created the aesthetic of editing.
Yeah.
Telling the story.
Oh, yeah, okay, so as far as your, just to go to Aaron Brockovich for a second, is there any particular sequence in Aaron Brockovich that you were really, really proud of when you saw that film? Like any particular sequence where you went, wow, that really came together in an interesting way? Because it's one of these films that is unique in as much, it is in some ways a quintessential Academy Award movie, an Oscar movie, in as much as it's both very populist and extremely artistic. You know?
I kind of remember the film. Trying to remember if there's one scene. It's always the scenes you're not sure it's going to come out or not. I mean, I could tell you a scene in The Limey that affected me. There's the scene when he first comes to L.A. and he's in the back of a cab at night.
Yes.
And it's a night shot, so I had a Kino flow out the window, and just enough that gave something to Terrence Stamp's character. And the generator went out. I ran out of gas, or it broke, or whatever, right? So how am I going to shoot this scene? I don't have a light, and we're out there and near the airport, and, you know, it's late.
Yeah.
So, and this only works, too, when you have a director that's willing to take chances, you know, and not blame you if you take the chance and it doesn't work out. Because I think many times cinematographers are trying to protect themselves, and that's where they limit themselves from taking chances, because they always get blamed for other people's reasons or whatever, you know. But I didn't have that problem with Steven, because Steven takes his own chances, and so he said to me, well, let's shoot it without lights. So I go, Now, I like to push film anyway, you know, because I always think
the film grain became so good it almost looked like digital to me. And so I always like to push the, back then it was, I don't know, 5279, 500 to 1,000 and overexpose it or stop.
Talking one stop.
Yeah, one stop. But there was a new stock that came out. It was 800, which I, at the time, I didn't really like. But I had a couple rolls of it.
And it was the same stock that was eventually used on Minority Report, I think.
Oh.
Okay, fine.
So I pulled it out, and I pushed it half a stop. And then I said to Stephen, well, let's shoot it, but at least let's shoot it near windows that have bright lights. So we found like a strip past the airport where there was like a lot of lit windows at night. And we shot that shot. And literally, looking through the viewfinder, I couldn't see if I could see Terrence or not. You know, I mean, he would be there and it would not and whatever. And we got the dailies back. It was the best shot in the film for me, because the color temperatures were changing, the light was changing to what was really in the environment. When you went by a bright window, you saw the bright window. When you went by a dark window, you saw a dark window. And it felt, you felt the alienation and the mood of the underbelly of LA, because we tried to shoot the film in places that you normally wouldn't shoot in LA to tell this kind of story, you know, or you would glorify, you know, the world. You know, we shot in a lot in East LA and down near the reservoir and whatever. And so it's always those experiences for me of something that I'm not sure exactly how it's going to come out. They're always educated guesses, but for me as a cinematographer, it's when I'm able to take the biggest chances that I'm find it interesting.
Most interesting. Well, I know the shot you're talking about, and I did not realize it was 800 speed, and it's a gorgeous shot. It's a gorgeous shot. When you made, now, I don't know when this started, but there's two films that I linked together in your career. I linked together because of, I guess, a feeling about the color or the way the images come across, even though they're very different films. And they're lensed completely differently. Mm-hmm. But we have to talk about them because there's two of the boldest, most phenomenal phenomenal efforts in photography, in motion picture photography that I've ever seen. And that many people have ever seen, whether they knew it or not.
Tell me what it is.
One is called Lawrence of Arabia. No. the two films are Far From Heaven, Todd Haynes, and A Prairie Home Companion.
Really?
100%. So we'll start. Well, you said really. So now we got to start with A Prairie Home
Companion. No, it'll be easier to start with Far From Heaven.
Let's start with Far From Heaven.
All right.
Far From Heaven. You had everyone repeated the Douglas Sirk references. It was like any critic on television was like so proud they could say it's really a Douglas Sirk film. I'm in the club.
Look at Mad Men. That's all.
And yet it was this very interesting soapy, you know, drama that sort of lived outside itself, because we knew. I mean, the subject matter was an issue for the time in which it was set, and yet the time in which it was set wasn't realistic at all. It was a movie version of a movie version of that time. Mm-hmm. And so you're watching it kind of like with this distance, and yet it sucked you in.
Right.
It sucked you into the story about this woman with this frustrated life and her husband with a frustrated life. And it related to the present through a kind of a filter, a lens.
Right. Right.
And your use of color in that, there was, if I'm not, I don't know if it was mixed lighting, but it was mixed palettes.
Right.
There were some scenes that were green. Right. There were some scenes that were blue. There were some scenes that were red. There was a bar scene where they go to dance and neon.
Orange and green.
Orange and green, yeah.
Well, what I would first say to respond to that is, it was Todd's exploration. He did this in Superstar, you know, the Karen Carpenter story.
Yeah.
Where, and I think it's something he's always explored in his milieu, in his language, is he was interested to see in 2003
if you could still use melodrama, how it works, the same way Cirque did in the 50s. Because in a certain sense, the artifice of it, allows people to their emotions. Like, we know we're being manipulated in so-called documentaries or reality, because we're very sophisticated now of knowing how one can be manipulated visually or storytelling-wise.
Right.
So the audience is on guard. But when the audience comes to something and say, I'm going to be part of this manufactured world, this artifice, which melodrama is, and what Cirque understood about melodrama. You know, Cirque came from Germany out of Brechtian ideas of theater and image. Where you create
Ulfus or no?
Pardon?
Was he contemporary Max Ulfus?
Yeah, well, yeah, Ulfus was a little before, okay. But or before, yes. But so he was into this idea of creating this cinematic language that was not naturalistic at all, that had a certain artificiality. And what he realized and how it worked was that psychologically it allowed people to enter their emotions. So what Todd did that was so compelling and interesting is he took social issues, and so did Cirque. Cirque used this, you know, when Cirque first came to this country, he couldn't get work because he was seen as a German. And he became like a script doctor. First he made documentaries in the wine country, right? But he became a script doctor. Actually said his favorite time in L.A., he had a chicken farm, whatever. But was, and then he got his break to do these, they were called weepies, or what we would consider soap operas. Mm-hmm. But what he did is he imbued certain social issues, race, gender. It wasn't overt at what Todd did, but Todd uses the question about homosexuality, race.
Yes.
So here are issues that we would certainly in 2003 feel so sophisticated about that we wouldn't be prejudicial. But it affects us emotionally because we are. And it allows people into the game through melodrama. So now on my behalf, visually, I was able to do something that I've always explored. I was back to German Expressionism. I could create color in a totally abstract way.
Mm.
That it wasn't, even the night, I created night differently. It's like I started the night in like a mauve, blue, purple. And as their relationship breaks down, it gets more to be an acid green blue.
Right.
Or like you mentioned, the club. When she goes to the club with Raymond, the gardener, the black gardener, those are all in saturated primary colors, green, orange, yellows, like nature. But when Frank, her husband, goes to the gay bar, it's in secondary colors. It's in magentas, cyans. Lime green, those are aberrations of primary colors. So I've done a lot of study in color, you know, from studying Joseph Auber, and there's been theoreticians about color. So I tried to use color on a psychological way, not in an aesthetic way to make the world pretty, but I tried to use it the way it could work, the way painters use color to evoke a certain emotional response to the characters. And then I was lucky enough to work with Sandy Powell, who created the wardrobe that reinforced that. Mm-hmm. You know, like the autumnal colors of their dresses when they're outside in the fall. And it's partly how I created those colors outdoors is I used tungsten lights outdoors, so tungsten lights would go orange rather than using HMIs. So I lit the leaves with those with the tungsten lights to make them a little warmer. I couldn't do that everywhere, but I could sneak it in certain places.
During the day or during the night?
No, during the day.
During the day, you would actually punch up?
Sometimes I would punch it up with using tungsten lights outdoors.
See, this is basically a circus for you. I mean, this was a real, you really stretched your legs on this.
Well, I was just trying to analyze how those films worked. And this is another maybe point was, Cirque worked in a studio. Those were studio-made films. Yeah. So you would always feel the interior, yes, and the exterior almost at the same balance.
Yes.
So it created a certain artificiality.
Yes. Okay.
So now I'm in a situation where I'm shooting in New Jersey, and I'm trying to make it look like Universal backlot.
Right. Yep.
So what do? I do everything possible in reality to make it feel like it's a set. So I have NDs on the windows wherever I could, change them all that, whatever the light was outdoors, so I could make the interior and the exterior almost the same, which you wouldn't normally do. You would, right, in real situation, you would leave
line.
It up. So then a comparison is, in Mildred Pierce, I had the opposite problem, where I was on a studio. We were out at the big stage out in Brooklyn. Oh, I forget the name of the stage. Anyway, Steiner Studios. And there, I tried to do everything to make the set look like I was on a real location. So I blew out the windows, played with color temperature. So I did everything to make the stage look naturalistic, to create a sense of reality for the story in Mildred Pierce, to get away from film noir, where in Far From Heaven is more of a melodramatic, you know, creating kind of like what's hidden on the surface. You know, it was a world that they couldn't be part of. The very thing they wanted, it kept them from their own desire. And the images are very lush because it's something they all want to obtain, these bourgeois middle class values that they're not able to, you know, have, because they all have these secrets that they can't deal with.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm not mistaken,
he needs you.
Yeah, we're gonna switch scripts.
Okay.
And then we'll finish.
I have a topic I want to get into, and then it's not the answer I would have thought.
Well,
and so then you go further with that.
I know. Well, that's what he did.
But
you know.
Okay.
So what was the, are you? Tell us when you're ready.
Now we're good.
Okay,
is this all right when I lean back? I don't want to look too comfortable.
Yeah, that's fine.
Can I just see? Show me what it looks
like. Yeah. Hold on. When you're back a little bit, we do see Trepo, but we're not caring about that kind of stuff. This is a more relaxed kind of environment.
Oh, you have the stand in, right?
Yeah, when you're there.
All right, I'll get
it. The only thing that's maybe a little weird is when you're super crunched over.
Yeah.
Because it kind of seems like you're coming out crooked out of the side.
All right, well, just tell me. That's fine. I'll be right here. All right, so what was the other film?
So it's interesting you mentioned about the exteriors and how you lit the leaves, because if I'm not mistaken, and again, I only saw the film once. I love the film. I saw it once. The last shot is a crane wide that goes up and away
from
Julianne Moore, right? And
it's a 90-foot crane.
I
was losing the leaves. It was winter already. We were very lucky. It was actually right around 9/11.
Right.
And for some reason, it was very overcast that like month. It was, I don't know, smoke or I don't know what it was. But it also helped me create this kind of idea that shooting in a studio, because it wasn't big sunlight, light and dark. It was very flat. And that day, it snowed just after we shot, and so it was very overcast weather. So that shot, the leaves are just hanging on, but because of the flatness of it, it feels not like you're really outdoors.
Well, it was a stunning shot, and it does have that. I mean, you know, you're outdoors because nobody, you know, there's no CGI, nobody built a backdrop to go back that far.
And they were all film opticals. We didn't do any digital opticals in the film because, again, Todd wanted to reference the way they would have done it. So even the imperfections of film opticals
is
how it was done. And also the color correction in that film was not a digital color correct, which was existing at that time.
Right.
But we did film color correct.
Right, so you graded everything.
Yeah, graded everything because, again, we wanted the same techniques as close as possible that Cirque and Russell Meddy would have had as cameramen, even though film stocks change. But I used
an older set of Cook Speed Pancro lenses that they could have used, but probably they used super Boltards. But I used the oldest set of lenses I could get to create again the feeling of that world.
It's fantastic. And when you saw the film projected finally, you know, I mean, you obviously timing the film and you were in on the process, but when you finally saw the final projection, was it breathtaking for you, or was it,
I mean, you're working on a film, you're too close to it to, you know, to know if it's going to reach an audience or not. I think we were all pleasantly surprised that it had such a wide kind of acceptance. And
Well, I think it did, probably because of what you said earlier, which is the audience that watched it convinced themselves that they didn't have any issues with homosexuality, with race, with bourgeois middle class values and
a woman's position in society.
Cirque
always dealt with the woman as the imprisonment of the culture, you know, that the woman could never act, she always had to act for the greater good of the community and not on her own individual needs or wants or wishes, which seems pretty archaic today, except when you listen to Romney on television.
Okay, so let's go to Prairie Home Companion. So it was probably only, I don't know, six years ago? I hadn't met my wife yet. It was five.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
I go to the theater because I, at this point, realize I haven't seen, I don't think, one Altman film released in the theater ever in my life. I'd seen, you know, because of just for whatever factors or whatever, I had never seen an Altman film in the theater. They'd all been watched. There probably was, but I don't remember what it was now. And I thought, well, this, you know, it's getting on, and I have to go. No, I'd seen Gosford Park, of course. It was another stunning picture. So I go to the theater, and I read up on a little bit on it, but not enough to. And I realize it's kind of this kind of quasi concert behind the scenes movie, but not really, with a bit of a storyline in it and all this stuff. And what emerged in front of me on the screen, this 2-3-5 letterboxed movie, was one of the most colorful, rich, and the blackest of inky blacks in any time. There was this contrast. It just enveloped me. And I thought, anybody not seeing this movie in the theater is missing out, man. I thought, they're just you're not going to get it. You can watch this on video, but if it doesn't have, like, you know, these shots to see with the roaming, zooming lenses and all that stuff. And now, you know, so it blew me away. But there's a couple things in it. There's a shot, somebody walks into the stage and it sort of cranes down as they go, to a mantle to pick something up, and I forget what it was. I think that's Kevin Kline.
Yeah.
There's a shot at the end of the diner where our Prairie Home Companion friends have come to gather, and we see the diner, and we lower down in the diner. There is the scenes of Woody Harrelson and John C. Reilly on stage, seemingly improvising, and knowing Robert Altman, I'm guessing it was improvising. Mm-hmm. And the scenes of Lily Tomlin and Meryl Streep backstage, improvising for sure. They're all completely different, and they're all mesmerizing for different reasons. Let's start with the Streep and Tomlin ones. You hit these little key. I mean, first of all, you've got mirrors everywhere. I left the theater, and I said to the person next to me, how did Ed Lockman do that? How did he manage to not show the cameras? Because there's 15 mirrors everywhere. And you had to light them. And you had to make it look compositionally nice. So how did you do it?
Well, first I had a great crew.
Okay.
I had my crew. That was the first digital film I ever shot.
It was digital?
With a Sony 900. Which, in a weird way, I actually prefer the Sony 900 back then to the Red.
Today.
I know there was something about the, and I had Fujion lenses, which I really liked. But the way I approached that was, I'm going to figure out the ASA of the digital world for that camera and light it the way I light film with my spot meter and my Polaroids and figure out what the latitude is of this. And if the highlights are going to burn out, I'm going to let them burn out. And I'm going to light it, again, naturalistically. I mean, part of the difficulty shooting with Altman, and I had heard this, is that he shoots with two or three cameras always. And he doesn't care if the cameras see each other. But the problem is, where do you put your lights?
Right.
You know? And he would laugh and say, that's your problem. But because what he wanted and what he's always been interested in is kind of an improvisational approach to discovering the images in the storytelling, the way he wants the performances to feel like a discovery and why he gives so much freedom. And I think sometimes it worked for him and sometimes it didn't. And I think it didn't work when he didn't have cameramen up to his level of exploring. But so I fell back with the same gaffer with, let's light it the way we would light a naturalistic film. Now, this was all behind the stage, on the stage. So it was in a theatrical situation, so I could light it. And if you see the lights, well, they're the theater, they're lights in the theater. So when you're downstairs with all those mirrors, there are all those lights around the mirror. So that lit that room, you know, because the one thing about the digital world, you know, you're shooting at ASA 600, 800, whatever. But then I could really rely on moving that camera. And there's, I think you're talking about this one shot that actually his son was our operator. He was a wonderful operator, Bobby Altman. And it was great because I'd always go through Bobby if I wanted something, because I always heard, and I had a wonderful rapport with Altman, and I had worked with him previously on, I finished Dr. T and His Women. I did the hurricane or tornado sequence. And that's when we hit it off, because he wanted to do rear screen projection. He wasn't sure how he wanted to do it. And I put the camera on a spinning turntable. And so when the wind and everything is moving the car, the camera's spinning, the car spinning, there's things flying through the air, and it looked totally, you know, it worked, you know, with rear screen projection, if you can believe that back then, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's a shot downstairs. We found out that there was an elevator in the floor of the stage that went up and down to the stage, because we actually shot where Prairie Home Companion actually takes place. So we actually designed a shot through Bobby suggesting it. It wasn't, I don't always like to take the credit. In fact, I'll give credit wherever credit's due. We actually did a shot from down behind, underneath the stage, and then the camera moves up through the stage up to the theater, and you're seeing the whole theater, and it's one shot moving downstairs, dolly on this platform, have the platform of the stage move us up, and then at a certain part, the crane takes over.
Right.
And anyway, that was my favorite shot in the film. But I can't say why that film worked as well as it did visually, you know, other than trying to light it like film. And
let's talk a little bit about John C. Reilly and Woody Harrelson on stage, because you did this wonderful, you know, it's very, very hard to shoot something that's taking place diegetically on stage for a film, right?
It's what's diegetically?
Like, as in the story world.
Oh, I see.
We know that that beyond the lens, what we're watching is a stage production.
I see.
Right.
I see.
Sorry. I'm...
No, that's good. Threw one at me. I didn't know what it was.
So we learned this in, you know, film theory class. Diegetically is, that's good. If the character's listening to headphones and you hear that music, that's diegetic, because it's in the story. Non-diegetic.
Well, I'll use that next time.
There we go. You're exchanging it.
Right.
So you have this. So this is a scene where all these characters are performing on stage.
Right.
And so you've got to light them so that they work when they're shot, but it's also supposed to look like stage lighting. Or not.
Well, it was stage lighting, and right. maybe when they go off the stage and they're dark or whatever,
I was just true to what that spatial relationship was with lighting, and that's what made it feel so authentic to you.
But you made it look. I mean, I know it was stage lighting
yeah.
you were using, but off, like if you took a lot of plays and you just shot them,
right,
it wouldn't look very good on camera because you'd see the multiple shadows everywhere. Uh-huh. This with Harrelson and Woody, or sorry, Woody right. and
John Reilly, John C. Reilly.
With Woody and John C. Reilly, this you saw their face, but there's this incredible green backlight that they had. I remember. I think it was green anyway.
Well, you know, we touched on it maybe, but when I use color,
yeah,
I only like to use two colors at the same time, and I like to use an advancing color and a receding color, almost like pop art.
Okay.
So probably I'm always playing with the depth of color.
Yeah.
So it isn't just using color as, again, a pictorial way, but using color for depth. And so maybe I did something like that using contrasting rather than complementary colors to create depth in the image. And in digital, that helps it feel more filmic.
Uh-huh. Okay, interesting. And as for the blacks of the movie, can you say anything about it?
Well, I think you just printing? Had a good projection, or maybe it was a bad projection. It was stark.
A very good projection.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But, of course, I work hard to keep... You know, in film, per se, to get rich black, you have to give some exposure so the film crystals are working to give you a black level.
Right.
Now, maybe in the digital world, I was also able to do that. I just didn't let things fall off to nothing. But I, again, through my spot meter, I was able to figure out a range of the negative or the digital, you know, format where I could read enough detail in the shadow detail that when I was in the post process, and a lot of these, you know, were transferred to film. You know, back then we didn't always show our digital films digitally because the theaters didn't have all digital projectors.
Yeah.
So by doing,
print.
Oh, well, that's part of the reason.
Yeah.
So possibly the digital format in the density in the low end translated into the negative as a rich black because there was something there to go with.
I get it.
I don't know. I'd have to see that scene, but it's just playing with the latitude, you know.
Favorite movie of yours?
I don't know, it always should be your last one, but it always isn't. I don't, you know.
So just to wrap up now, we're gonna play a little Audible Rorschach. I'll say a name, and you can talk for 30 seconds to a minute about them, because what we're gonna do is have cinematographers talking about other cinematographers.
All right.
The most recently, unfortunately, deceased Mr. Harris Savides.
Well, Harris, you know, we were friends professionally and socially. He worked with my gaffer when he could. And John even said to me the morning he died, how his phone was ringing the night or the day before, and it was always from Harris, and he didn't understand why his number was always coming up. And he told me this story that, and this typifies the kind of person Harris was. He would call John up and say, I just want to ask you first, if you're working with Ed, or you're going to, if Ed's talked to you about the next job, I don't want to interfere. But if you're available, I'd like you to work on my next project. He was a gentleman. And he had a wonderful eye. And there are very few people in any craft or any work that has a passion and compassion towards what they do. And
Harris always had a very passionate, and also people came first to him. It wasn't just about, well, when you talk to crew that worked with Harris, because many of the crew I worked with him, they only had the nicest things to say about him, that he respected everybody as an equal.
Favorite films of Harris's, favorite work?
Huh. Well, I like some of Gus Van Sant's work that he did. I like what he did for Ridley Scott.
And American Gangster.
Yeah. And I know that was a tough film to work on. And Greenberg. He shot Greenberg, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful little picture.
And he worked with Sophia. And
Sir Roger Deakins.
I was a big fan of Roger's when he was in England. I knew Roger before anybody. I worked with his gaffer in England on Mississippi Masala. I called Roger up to get his gaffer, John Higgins, when I shot in Africa. And I loved the film he shot with Mike Figgis. What was it? It was a gangster film in Nottingham.
You're getting me. Just a second. We'll get it from the researcher over here.
But anyway, there's always an intelligence to what Roger does visually, and he's a wonderful operator, and the way he tells a story with a camera. I'm always excited when I go to see. I love the Man Who Wasn't There, and the other film that I loved was it was about the guy that's Jewish and.
Serious Man.
What?
Serious Man.
Yeah, I love the way that film was shot. And I love some of the other Coen brothers that he shot.
Yeah. The list goes on. Mr. Gordon Willis.
Well, Gordon Willis was like, you know, there was Victoria Storaro and Gordon Willis, you know. So, you know, in that period of time, Gordon set cinematic language. He, like, put his fingerprint on his style of lighting. And that he was such a strong component in the storytelling. You know, that when you went to see a film that Gordon shot, you knew you would see something of Gordon in the film. And so he had the respect of all cinematographers for that.
Ed Lockman, thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
And we want to see nothing but more Ed Lockman images for the next 100.
Hopefully I don't have to talk too much anymore.
Okay, so now that we've done that, now I'll introduce you.
All right.
Beginning. That's what I do. I found that the minute I introduce someone, and any time I do this, and I start at the beginning, it threw them off. Right? Because I'm introducing to the camera.
Oh.
Right? And then if we just started talking and we kept talking and we kept talking and we kept talking,
right.
The better and better it got. So I realized.
Oh, that's fun.
Okay. Welcome back to Craft Truck.
Sorry, let me actually
go. Okay, fine.
Because you've been jumping in and out of frame.
That's okay, because as we, you know, it's only.
Oh, you got plenty. How long did we shoot? I mean, how long?
Good 2 hour of footage at least.
How long?
More
than an hour.
I'd love to see how you cut it.
Yeah, so do I.
We'll save it because it's probably.
Oh no, we don't. Oh. We won't. Okay, so we're good.
Yeah. Just
welcome back to Craft Truck.
Yeah, good.
Okay, there we go.
No.
Okay.
No, there's a big glare in your sunglasses. Okay.
Okay. Welcome back to Craft Truck Through the Lens. Welcome back to Craft Truck Through the Lens. We are privileged to be in the studio and home of one of cinema's greatest cinematographers, a man who has worked in many genres and has always
evolved and developed as an artist, never ceasing to push themselves and to explore new territory, Mr. Ed Lachman. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.